Okay, so we're ready. Okay. Okay, ladies, we've made it to the very end. Are we ready? Okay. So it's my pleasure to introduce our final speaker for today, Dr. Pam Hoffley. Dr. Hoffley is the quality associate chief quality officer at Dartmouth Hitchcock. She primarily practices down at Dartmouth Hitchcock, Manchester, where she's the associate medical director. She's the chief of pediatric gastroenterology. She received her BA and her MD at Queen's University of Kingston, Ontario, Canada, and here to speak on not just celiac, on all kinds of tummy aches.
So when I turn this on, the top is a button. There you go. Yep. There you go. So everyone hear me through there? Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I can usually talk loud, and usually people are telling me to be more quiet. So. So it's really hard to be here at the end of the day, and I think that your last speaker sounds like it's a tough act to follow. although a lot of what we're going to talk about today has an awful lot to do with what she's been talking to you about, too, and that's a lot of what I'm going to stress. It's the end of the day and keeping people awake. I do much better if people interrupt me and ask questions. I don't know what you know, what you don't know, what you really want to know about, and what I might have on these slides might have nothing to do with what your questions are. So it's better to just stick up your hand. I've been doing this for long enough that I can do this on the fly, and we don't have to follow along with what's on here either. And it can answer your questions so that you get out of this what you need and what you want, and not just what I decided to put on some slides. Okay? Does that sound reasonable? So I expect to be interrupted, because I get bored listening to me too.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get this. So I go back so many stomach aches. I think that is a big part of the life of a school nurse. Is that fair to say? it's a big part of my life, but more often than not, the parent comes to me and says, my child has been to the school nurse X number of times, and that's why we're here. So I know you guys are dealing with it as much, if not more, than I am. So a definition of chronic abdominal pain is intermittent or constant pain for at least 2 months. It's not rare. So they did a community-based study, and we're talking 17% of middle and high school students reported weekly episodes of abdominal pain. You guys probably knew that part. Among the pupils who reported it, 21%, the pain was so severe that it stopped them from doing activities. So again, this not too rare. This is a pretty common problem. We kind of divided into two broad categories. Chronic abdominal pain with functional disorders, 90% or more, and organic disorders. And it's important to remember that the two are not mutually exclusive. Many kids who have an organic disease, whether they have inflammatory bowel disease, celiac disease, peptic ulcer disease, are also just entitled to be among the 90% that have functional pain to go with it. And it's important to recognize that. So the formal definition, you had it more than 3 times, it affected your activities, it occurred over 3 months, and we didn't find an organic cause, is what we call recurrent abdominal pain. And they're now getting away from that sort of definition. We don't want to call it functional abdominal pain anymore because people don't like that word. They think it sounds like, oh, do you think it's all in my head? Do you think I'm crazy? And we also want to recognize that it's not like a specific diagnosis either. It's a symptom complex, and so we're going to call it recurrent abdominal pain is a description, but it's not a diagnosis. So we're just going to call it recurrent abdominal pain, but we're not going to try to label it as a diagnosis unless we can actually come up with something real to call it. That then, because when we have a diagnosis, then we have a plan that matches the diagnosis and something that we can do. And recurrent abdominal pain is not a diagnosis. Functional abdominal pain is not a diagnosis. It doesn't help anyone because that doesn't come with something to do about it. And we want to do something. So the important one I wanted to have up here for you guys, and this is the kind of list that when they show up for the third time in the office, my stomach hurts. These are the ones that you want to get it to us sooner than later, to the gastroenterologist. So it's someplace specific, but not in the middle. Like it's right up there or right up there. It happens at night and it wakes them up. They're tired at school because they got up last night because it hurts so much. I think it's pretty obvious if they're vomiting a lot, they've got a lot of diarrhea, they're losing weight, they're not growing, there's fevers and there's blood in their stool. Those ones are pretty obvious. But if you see any of these, those are what we call alarm symptoms. We want to see those kids a little sooner than later. I'm going to head back here. What's interesting is that the kids who have the organic pain and the organic, especially the IBD patients, tend to be the ones that don't come to the nurse. They show up in our office and they have hung in there for months with bloody stool and waking up at night and doing all of these things. And the kid who actually has functional pain has already visited you 30 times. And this kid didn't miss a day of school, not one. And that's actually, if you haven't missed any school, I think you have organic pain. There's something really wrong if you didn't miss school. And that, just after 30 years of it, that's where I'm at. Features that suggest that it's what we call psychophysiologic or functional pain. It's kind of vague. Where does it hurt? I don't know. Over. I don't know. When does it start? I don't know. It's always there. I have a headache and my arms hurt and my legs hurt. And they look totally healthy. And they ate lunch. And they're fine. And there's often some other stressors or some other stuff going on that's actually the real reason they might be there to talk to you. But they never can tell me anything about where it is or what it's related to. And I'm like, but you got all the way here to my office. And could you tell me something more? No. So this is the part where you guys can really help sort of tease that out, because I have 40 minutes. The pediatrician's got 15 minutes these days. You know the family better than we do. You know the environment. You know what's going on. But that's psychosocial history and that part of it. It's a lot of this functional pain has a lot to do with what's going on in the home, whether it be something bad or stressful, or whether it's just that this pain is getting reinforced by getting lots and lots of attention from parents, being allowed to stay home with it if things aren't going well at school, and that whole interaction between, you know, how stressed a kid is and the pain that they're experiencing is very real. And I'm not sure how much they touched on that in the whole anxiety talk, but we certainly see that. I've had parents insist to me that no, it couldn't possibly be because of, you know, something at school. And one young man I remember meeting, and he got very, very sick three times in the year, all having to do with the SATs. But his mother assured me that he wasn't stressed about it. He really wanted to do well, and that was not the reason he'd gotten sick and couldn't get there. I'm like, yeah, sure. So it's real, but you guys can help us a lot by teasing that out, and we're always happy to get a note from you or send it to the PCP, because you have so much more info than we have about this, and it's sometimes very hard for us to tease it out in the office from the kid who won't talk to us in front of his parents, who maybe won't tell us his parents are yelling at each other, or won't tell us what's going on at school, because not only does he not want to tell me about his bad grades, he doesn't want his mother to find out about them either. So it really helps us if you can get in there about it. So the diagnosis of functional pain could be made without additional testing in kids who meet these criteria. They've got none of those list of alarm findings, normal physical, and you might just do a stool sample for occult blood, and then you're done. That we don't need the mega million-dollar workup. In some cases, when you're on the fence about it, a little bit of weight loss, maybe some diarrhea, maybe they woke up at night, a CBC and a SED rate might be all that you do. And if some such testing is performed, it's helpful to set the expectation that these are going to be normal before you start. Not that we're doing this because we think we're going to find something. We're going to do this just to make sure, but my expectation is this is normal, and we'll send you a letter that says it's normal, and don't worry about it. extensive evaluation we get, which we get pushed to, are you sure? Can we do this test? Can we do that test? Is extremely expensive. The yield is really low. And you're actually delaying getting the kid into what they need, which is talking to the lady who was here before me, and not me. And me sticking scopes in all kinds of places and sitting needles. And it almost reinforces that if I'm willing to do this to you, I must think there's something wrong that I'm going to find, because I wouldn't be so mean to do all these things to you if you didn't think. So then they're really just stuck in that cycle of there must be something wrong with me, and you just haven't found it yet, and what more tests can we do? So really try to hold the line, unless there's alarm findings, to not do it. And you can help us with that by reinforcing it. Some of the hardest things are when other family members or people in the school have said, you should go back to the doctor and ask again and see if she'll do more tests. It's like, thanks. That, helping to reinforce that can be really, really helpful to us, and not make sure you ask for this test or that test, because it just reinforces that something's wrong. So the most common cause of why they're coming to see you is irritable bowel syndrome. Chronic abdominal pain, altered bowel habits in the absence of any alarm findings. We'll go through it a little bit later. Irritable bowel syndrome is a little tricky. I have irritable bowel syndrome. Most people. Who has irritable bowel syndrome? Only one is going to admit to it? Come on. No one gets, their stomach upset when they have a test, or they're going to fly, or they're, No? Yeah, okay, we all do. So, and in fact, you're all very normal, healthy people, and no one's going to admit to it, because it turns out that they did a large study of several thousand women, all of this sort of demographic and age that we all are, and they said, asked them to write down symptoms, do a symptom diary for 2 weeks of everything that you felt up here, down here, every pain, every cramp, everything that you felt. And there were no difference between the IBS group and the normal group, except that the people who had IBS thought that they were ill and that this was abnormal. And I asked people, how do you know you need to go to the bathroom? It hurts. You're uncomfortable. You get a cramp and you go, I need to go to the bathroom, and off you go. How do you know you ate too much? Get some discomfort, you get some reflux, you don't feel so good. Or how do you know you're stressed? How do I know that I'm stressed and something's bothering me? Well, a couple extra trips to the bathroom. And my husband says we always have to go to the airport half an hour earlier because I have to make sure I get there to the bathroom because I don't like to fly. So that's really what IBS is about. It's normal bowel habits, it's normal sensations, it's normal stuff going on, but it's that perception that it's abnormal. And some people talk about people having a heightened awareness of the physical things that are going on in their gut. They seem to feel everything moving. What's a normal amount of gas or a normal amount of stool, they feel. So that's what that is. And so just even with these, a lot of teenage girls, it's more girls than boys, sort of just, it's okay, it's normal. It's normal to feel like this before a test. And maybe some of those anxiety measures treating the anxiety will get things under control so that you can get to this test without having to go to the bathroom. So this is what we were talking about compared with healthy volunteers. Kids with irritable bowel probably have a lower rectal pain threshold in response to meals. They have abnormal pain referral with rectal distension. The most important one is higher anxiety and depression scores than those who don't have symptoms. So this can be more of the red flag for the anxiety and depression than a red flag for something organic wrong. And treating their anxiety and depression is just, if not more important, than anything I'm going to find, like celiac disease or anything there. It's important that we address this. And so this is the alarm finding for that. Constipation is the other biggie that causes chronic abdominal pain. large stools, very common. We find this, most kids are too busy and won't use the school bathrooms. And so they get backed up. They don't have time in the morning to get, because they're on the way to the bus, and then no one's going to poop at school because no one wants anyone to smell it. And so then by the time they get home, or it's after practice or whatever, whatever was there in the morning is completely dried out, and we're having a hard time going. So talking to them about maybe finding the time in the morning, drinking enough fluids, and the importance of, yes, you do have to go every day. And some people think that's not true, but yes, you do have to go every day. And if you don't sit there for long enough and spend enough time and you do 9 pieces instead of 10, then at the end of the month you have 30 extra and you're all backed up and uncomfortable. So some kids who say, I go every day, it's where it's important to talk about how hard is it, because if it's hard, it's been there a while. It's dried up. And so you may go every day and think you're going enough, but if you don't go quite enough, you end up full. There's constipation. So common organic causes that we'll just go through quickly that you can think about in kids with who are coming to see you: infections, peptic ulcer disease, lactose intolerance, reflux, IBD, and celiac disease. And we're going to talk a little bit today about celiac disease. We can go over some of those others if you want, but they're all pretty obvious when they happen. So celiac disease is malabsorption because you've got inflammatory injury to the small intestine after you eat wheat gluten or related rye and barley proteins. So the second part is you have to get better when you go on a gluten-free diet and relapse if we put gluten back in. We don't do that to anybody anymore, but that's the definition of celiac disease. So celiac disease is not a new disease. It dates back to the first century. You can see evidence of this. So it's not become more common. We are diagnosing it more because we're better at looking for it. But it's been around forever. And it was actually first described in the 1940s by a Dutch pediatrician that saw kids get better when there were food shortages. And then when they got all their cereal back, they got sick again. And some people describe it in Italy and in Ireland, related to taking communion on Sundays. That was the only time they were getting wheat protein, and they'd all get sick after they'd been to church. So the prevalence is a little difficult to ascertain how much of this is out there, because actually many patients have atypical symptoms. And they did a big, Italy is a place where they're doing a lot of research on celiac disease. And if you do the blood work for it, like sample a huge population, they found 7 new cases in kids for each patient that had established disease. So we're missing lots and lots of these. Not that I want to do labs on everybody. Highest rate is in Western Europe and in places that Europeans immigrated to, because there is an HLA type that's specific to having celiac disease. It is found a little bit in India and maybe underdiagnosed in South America, North Africa, and Asia. We're starting to see more of it because we're looking. Rare in people from purely African, Caribbean, Chinese, or Japanese background, little bit of a female prevalence. So we're saying 1 in 120 to 1 in 300 people in Europe and North America. So you should have in a school of 500 kids, 4 kids with celiac disease. Probably, is that about what you guys are seeing now? Or not? I mean, it depends if you look. I mean, people have to be looking for it. When I worked at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, all of the doctors that worked there had immigrated from Scotland, which is where I was born. My dad was one of those doctors that came over. And celiac disease was really well known in Britain and in Europe. So when I did my GI fellowship at SickKids, we were making a diagnosis of celiac every week. It was just something we did. Everybody had celiac disease, and we found tons of it. Real deal. And then I went down to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I was working down there. And the first week I was there, I diagnosed someone with celiac disease. And I mentioned it to someone. They said, what do you mean you diagnosed someone with celiac disease? We never see that. I'm like, I saw it in this kid. Oh, no, we don't see it. You made that up. And then I diagnosed someone the next week, and they said, Pam, what are you doing? Like, we don't see celiac disease here. And I said, I only drove 8 hours. It wasn't that far. this demographic's kind of the same. They weren't looking, and unless you look, you're not going to find it. But I just had been brought up that was what it was, and doctors had been trained differently, not badly or anything like that, and we're starting to get better and better at it, at finding it. So it's not rare. I don't know if anyone cares that it's an inappropriate T-cell mediated immune response and you have to be genetically predisposed. The classic presentation is infants between the ages of 4 and 24 months, and that's that picture you see in your textbooks of the little skinny kid with a really big belly, and you're not going to miss this one. If you did, that's a problem. If they don't get treated, they get short stature and they look terrible. That's the easy one. The atypical one is the tough one. It's probably more common. They don't really have features of malabsorption. The only thing they might have is chronic abdominal pain, some constipation, maybe some stomatitis, maybe some joint pains, and maybe some dental enamel defects. How much does this sound like the kid with functional abdominal pain? My tummy sort of hurts. My joints hurt, I don't feel good. It's all sort of the same. So backing up 10 slides, I said, just do a CBC and a SED rate. I am a sort of throw this TTG in with it when you stick the blood in. This is more common than we realize. And so I am a proponent of doing that. Usually around age, especially in around 7 to 12 year olds. I would look. It's more common than we realize. This is the other one, depression, irritability, and poor school performance, which is reversible when you treat it. And that's a really cool thing. The number of parents who've said to me, I have a new child once they get on the diet. This is interesting. I remember a girl, and some of you may have heard, if you've ever heard me speak, have heard this story. A girl came to my office, and she was about 16 or 17, and it was a few years ago, so it was when that goth thing was in, and it was all the black hair and black chains, and she'd been sent to me for constipation. She's sitting in the office, and she was nasty. Like, she did not want to be there, not happy to see me, and she was really kind of not nice to me at all. And I said, well, you've been sent here for constipation. You don't want to talk to me. And I think, I don't know. You're having a blood test. I like her very much. You're having a blood test. Her TTG, which is the tissue transglutaminase antibody, which normal is less than 4, was above 100. Okay. I felt terrible when I got the result back. Called her up. We did an endoscopy. She had celiac disease. I saw her back in follow-up like 6 weeks later, blonde hair. Happy, her mother came with me, hugged me. Thank you for giving me my daughter back. Now, it's not the treatment for every child who has this, but it was one of those ones where it was like, wow, this like turned this kid around. And she really just had been feeling terrible. And this was her, this is where she was. She was depressed, she was upset, and couldn't sort of verbalize it. And she made me mad, got a blood test, and it probably helped her out. So we actually do screen a lot of kids who, if you make it to us with constipation and abdominal pain, you're getting screened for celiac disease. That we just do. Treatment is a gluten-free diet. And this is really rough. Lifelong commitment, 100% adherence. It's expensive, and it can be socially limiting. So this is why this is the most important thing. We don't just try out a gluten-free diet. The reason we don't just try out a gluten-free diet is that if you really have celiac disease, you have to stick to it 110%, or you still have ongoing little bits of inflammation and you're at risk for lymphomas and things when you're older. So I don't want to take someone who may actually have celiac disease, put them on the gluten-free diet, never saw anyone, never got a diagnosis, they don't really believe it, and they cheat all the time, And then you've put them at risk because you never made the right diagnosis, but maybe they did feel better. Oh, I felt so much better on my gluten-free diet, but then they never follow through. It's really important because they need to understand that if you really have this, you got to do it, the whole thing, and you can't cheat. So I want to make that diagnosis, and that's why we really push that. Don't just try the diet out. So as far as we're concerned, there is no role for an empirical trial of gluten withdrawal, because then I can't make the diagnosis if you're not. I might miss it if I go look for it later because you still have some symptoms or you hadn't. Maybe you didn't do the diet right. I can't tell. The blood work changes. Everything changes. So that's not to say that if you come and see us and I do lab work and it's normal, that you can't do a trial of a gluten-free diet. I didn't say that. But you need to get tested first before you do the trial of the gluten-free diet. And it's really important because we don't want to miss the real thing. And important, and we can go back to that. Does anyone have questions about that diet part?
I just have a question about what is the actual definitive diagnosis for celiac? What is the test?
Biopsying the intestine.
That's what I thought. Okay. So people who say, oh, I think I have celiac, but they've never had a biopsy, you can't say it's a diet.
No. I mean, I do have people who've... So, if your TTG is above 100, there's good data now to suggest that it's very unlikely you would have a normal biopsy. So they probably have celiac disease, and there's some high-risk kids with Down syndrome or high-risk for an anesthetic that I would talk to their parents honestly and maybe defer doing that. The interesting thing is one of the other reasons I do the scope is we find other things when we do the scope. If you have active celiac disease, you have to understand that's a gut that immunologically is abnormal, and we'll find Helicobacter pylori, eosinophilic esophagitis, other Giardia infections, all kinds of other stuff. And you went and treated what was really celiac disease with a TTG over 100, you bring the TTG right down, and they don't get any better because we missed all these other things. So an upper endoscopy in an older kid is a 5-minute procedure. They get given some medication to make them sleepy. They're not intubated. It's not a big deal. It's safer than driving to get it done. And it also helps them believe that they have this, that it didn't just came off a blood test. It wasn't just mom decided I had it. And I have the ability to show them pictures of their flat gut, of the ulceration. I can show them pathology. You must believe. And it really helps when they're 18, and I made the diagnosis when they were 8, that I can show it to them when I'm trying to get them to keep going. So,
what do you say to all the people that think they have a gluten sensitivity?
So we'll get to that. So gluten sensitive, so that's why I was saying it's important. So I didn't say you couldn't do a gluten-free diet and try it out. Go to town. Gluten, when you take gluten out of someone's diet, the first thing that you've done is removed processed foods. So pretty much anyone in this room who decides to go on a gluten-free diet is going to feel better because you're not eating a whole bunch of junk that you were eating before. And we'll talk about it is gluten is what's called a FODMAP. Have people heard of FODMAPs? Mm-hmm. Fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. There's certain sugars and starches in our diet that we don't digest very well. Anything you don't digest goes to your colon. Your bacteria eat it. They produce gas and fermentable diarrhea, and you feel gassy and bloated and awful. So the more FODMAPs you eat, the more gassy and bloated you're going to be, no matter what. Some people more sensitive than others. So since you go on a gluten-free diet, you remove the largest FODMAP there is, and you're going to feel better. So there's nothing wrong with a gluten-free diet. But at least if you know you don't have celiac disease, you can cheat a little bit, and it's okay. So there's nothing wrong. And so gluten-sensitive really is, yeah, you could be gluten-sensitive. There's no doubt about that. Some people are more kind.
I guess my question is, how did these kids say, you know, if they've had it, if it's almost like a congenital or it's a genetic predisposition, how did they get to be 12, 18? You know, they must have sort of, they felt lousy their whole life.
Well, no. So probably 25% of us in this room have the HLA type for celiac disease, okay? It's sort of like many of the autoimmune diseases that run, you might have the HLA type that predisposes you to diabetes if there's diabetes in your family, thyroid disease, any of these autoimmune diseases. It's a genetic predisposition, and then something else happens that triggers it, whether it's a viral illness. People have gone with the theories of it's because we introduced cereal too young, and so everybody went to rice cereal, and now actually in the last 6 months that's turned around and said that probably made it worse and you should eat gluten earlier. No one can do that, but it's really that two-hit hypothesis that goes with just about any autoimmune disease. You're genetically predisposed and something happened and triggered it off. And you do see more of it in families, probably because whatever the exposure was that's triggered it got to everybody in the family or with something there. But we have not identified what it is. No one knows. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So what happens if somebody who kind of just feeling well, just decided to do the gluten-free diet, feeling great, never got the celiac disease diagnosis, and you said, now it's changed their whole makeup, right, or whatever, so a test isn't going to be definitive.
That's right.
So
when they, if we see them, we suggest that they eat the equivalent of one piece of bread a day for at least 8 weeks, and then we draw the blood. And if it comes back normal, the TTG is very sensitive now, then okay, great, you're all set. But if it starts to rise, then we would suggest that we investigate them further for celiac disease. They should challenge. As with really any food allergy or any food you can grow out of almost any food allergy, you should be retested and rechallenged. You don't want to stick to something for life if you don't have it. It's expensive, it's painful to do. So I would suggest a rechallenge. That's what we suggest.
Will most pediatricians run a TTG, or do they need to come see a specialist?
No, most of them will run it now. I think we have fully educated. We're getting fewer and fewer who come to us without their TTG done. So.
I've had a couple kids just recently diagnosed with megacolon and constipation and colon. Is there any recommendation? Is it just because they're not going to the bathroom at school? Is there any recommendation for pediatricians to look at?
We do recommend it with chronic constipation. You see iron deficiency, chronic constipation, and real deal functional, chronic abdominal pain, that it's worth doing a TTG. We do recommend. So if they come to us, if they had a megacolon and came to us, they would get a TTG because that's a sort of just going to happen. Yeah. Yeah. So that's where we find it. So this is the important part about school and in calming parents down. Exposure to gluten is not life-threatening. This is not an IgE-mediated allergy like peanuts, where bad things can happen if the kid gets hold of peanuts. The classroom does not need to be gluten-free, and they can sit next to someone eating a sandwich. There is no truth to the matter that you can breathe in gluten from the sandwich sitting next to the other kid. It doesn't happen. So anaphylaxis does not occur. Doesn't. Period. Unless you have some IgE-mediated gluten allergy, which is really, 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 really rare. People with celiac disease, it's not life-threatening, and you don't get anaphylaxis, and you can't get it from breathing it. And there's tons of articles on that, and if anyone wants it, we've had people who thought that they breathed it because someone over there had a sandwich. It's like, no. Okay? It's an IgA, IgG-mediated reaction. It's slow. It has to have direct contact. It's not, and you can even, if you're a mom who has celiac disease, you can actually make sandwiches and do things for your kids and then wash your hands and be fine. Okay? So. Optimal treatment does require 100% compliance and symptoms from exposure. So not to say that if the kid stole a sandwich from his friend, he's going to have a good day. Some kids may be fine. It's almost worse if they are fine because then they're convinced that because they cheated a whole bunch of times and nothing happened. That's almost harder to deal with because they're getting chronic inflammation. And some will get vomiting and diarrhea. So probably the biggest cause, yeah.
So what amount do you have to suggest to get symptoms? Like, say if you're baking, you know, not everyone in the family has celiac disease, and you use, say, a baking pan, and there's a little bit of regular flour that, I mean, is it minute amounts that...
It really varies from person to person how sensitive they are as far as getting symptoms. So what we, my, our approach to it in general is probably a little bit of it's not going to hurt as far as that sort of exposure. So what I do suggest to people is be 100% at home. So change the baking pan, use the different toaster, use the different things. Just make sure home is perfect so that when they go out, they don't have to tell, you don't have to tell the neighbor that she has to use a different plate for your kid, and no one wants to have the child over ever because you're so upset about every single piece of gluten that could touch them. And I tell the kids that too. It allows them to go out with their friends to dinner, and if they inadvertently eat a crouton, it probably nothing will happen actually than if they're letting things slide at home. So if you're perfect at home, and really, because it's easier to get the home environment cleaned up and keep it perfect, get rid of the shampoos with oatmeal, get rid of everything that's got gluten in it, and then you don't have to worry when they're at friends' houses and things like that. They're less likely to have a problem. So that's the way I approach it. And then some kids are different. I mean, some kids are very sensitive, and they will throw up. I mean, you get to know. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk a little bit about is the most common cause of abdominal pain. What kids eat. I mean, kids come to the office and parents hand us just the most amazing diet records. I look at it and go, you didn't want to lie a little bit about this? you knew you were going to fill this out, so I wouldn't have put these things down, but no, they're just out there, and I'm like, and you thought this was good. So common complaints were poor diet's a major factor, all of the things we just talked about. Poor school performance being a big part of it. If you don't eat breakfast, you got a headache, you can't function, so all of those things. This is a typical teen day. They don't get breakfast, and they have pizza and soda, bagels, soda. They eat fast food. I mean, I get diet records 2 weeks long with fast food for every meal. It's like, wow, I go to McDonald's once, I got a stomach ache. I still go. I go again. And 3 hours later, I'm like, why did they do that? But Big Macs are good. But the other thing is that I don't think I have a disease when I get a stomach ache after I ate a Big Mac. I ate a Big Mac. I got a stomach ache. So, but people seem confused by this, that I could eat at McDonald's and Wendy's and all these places, but all my friends eat it and they don't get sick. It's like, well, they're lucky. But most people do. So this is the other scary one. I couldn't believe this. Soft drinks supply 20 to 24% of calories for 2 to 19-year-olds. I mean, that's a lot. I got caught. I didn't realize this before. And a few years ago in my cystic fibrosis clinic, I had a teenager I was working really hard on getting to gain weight. And she was doing really well. But she was getting stomach aches. And so I told her, well, don't drink soda. That's terrible. It's all gassy. It's really bad for you. And she came back a month later and she'd lost weight because I took 20% of her calories out of her diet. She switched over to healthier drinks. So I tried to get away with not telling her to go back and drink Coke, but in fact, it was helping her. But it's a big part of their diets. And it contains this magic word, high fructose corn syrup. Now, if you get Coke from Mexico, it does have sucrose and glucose, but the Coke we get here has high fructose corn syrup. Most of the sodas do. Powerade does, not Gatorade. Powerade is made with high fructose corn syrup. And fructose is a funny sugar. So most of the other sugars in our diets, some of them are disaccharides where we break them up into glucose and galactose and other things. And we have active transport mechanisms, ways to get them into our bloodstream and out of our gut. Fructose, we don't have a transport mechanism for in our guts. We can't transport it very well. So it's sort of a passive diffusion method. Some people are really good at it. Someone's putting their Coke away. So some people are really good at absorbing fructose, and some people are really bad at absorbing fructose, and you can actually measure how good people are at it. And if you take a group of four-year-olds who are drinking lots of juice, there'll be this pile of kids who are chubby, chubby, chubby. And they're really good fructose absorbers. And then there's a really skinny kid who's having diarrhea, and he's the really bad fructose absorber. And then most of us fall somewhere in between. But anyone other than the kid who's a super-duper fructose absorber who drinks too much of this, that sugar travels to your colon, gets digested by bacteria, and again, you're going to have gassy stomach cramps, may have some diarrhea, and not feel good. And this is probably one of the major causes of stomach aches that kids are getting. Add some fructose. Take some fructose and add in sugar-free gum. What's in sugar-free gum? Sorbitol. Okay. So a little bit of a little bit of Coke, Sprite, and some sugar-free gum, and off we go. Really bad stomach ache. And they don't just drink one, they drink five, and they have the whole pack of sugar-free gum. So you guys could be able to pick that stuff up. This is the one you get. Ask them how much soda they're drinking, how much sugar-free gum they're chewing, the sorbitol, the high-fructose corn syrup, and you'll be a miracle worker who will cure abdominal pain in teenagers.
About seltzer water. Nutrition said that we shouldn't be drinking seltzer water. It has no sugar in anything, but the bubbles are not.
Well, they're carbon, so it's gas. Okay. I mean, you're swallowing gas. So you know kids who are air swallowers and then they burp. But I mean, if you introduce air into the system, air stretches. I mean, that's what you feel pain in your gut. Pain is from stretch. So the more gas that goes in, the more dilated it is, the more pain you get. So if you drink lots of bubbles, then you get stomach aches. And no one does just one seltzer water. You have to have the big bottle, and so you've got lots of gas. And then also, when you're drinking soda out of the bottles, you swallow more air as well. Does that make sense? So that's the thing with seltzer. I have a little trouble with seltzer. What?
I was thinking of a student who drinks a lot of soda and Kool-Aid and all that.
Well, Kool-Aid. Yeah. So the one you should drink is this one. There's the one that non-carbonated. Doesn't upset my stomach. So this is the FODMAPs I was talking about. This is very in. People heard about FODMAPs? That's the real deal. So FODMAPs are everywhere. And their restriction of their intake actually seems to reduce functional gut syndrome symptoms. So remember when we went back to people with IBS feel things more than people who don't have IBS, and what you're feeling is stretch. So anything you can do to reduce the gas load in the gut will reduce symptoms and pain. And these are the foods that cause gas. It's not just beans anymore. It's all of these and FODMAPs. And then so fructose, lactose, polyols, and galactins are the that's where the gluten-free diet comes in. It's one of the FODMAPs. People do feel better on it, and so it has a pretty high compliance rate. The nice thing about this is you don't have to stick. Like, you don't have to 100% be free of every single one of these. But it's nice to know which ones are which and sort of reduce them in the diet, and not have an entire meal of FODMAPs. An example, having apples with a bagel and cream cheese are all FODMAPs. And then if you put some broccoli and dipped it in ranch dressing, that would be some more. You can choose different fruits. There's lots of fruits and lots of vegetables that aren't FODMAPs. Sometimes this is why people feel better on lactose-free diets who aren't actually lactose intolerant, because lactose is a FODMAP. You feel better on a gluten-free diet because gluten's a FODMAP. But it turns out maybe you could just take bits of all the FODMAPs out and you wouldn't have to be zero on one of them. You maybe tolerate a little bit of lactose if you weren't having your lactose with another FODMAP. So. And you can Google FODMAPs, and there's tons of stuff out there to read about them. So low FODMAP diet is an effective approach to management of patients. So this is something you can go ahead and try. Anyone can go ahead and try this at home without a blood test, because you're not taking any particular food out 100%. And people do feel better. Anyone feels better on a low FODMAP diet. But in the end, here we are. We tried all those things. My tummy still hurts. And that's
question. I think I always feel like a lot of my kids don't really talk about the not pooping. So I call the parent and say, I think they always have pain after they eat, intermittent, it goes away. And I always say, you know, you should probably go get an x-ray. Is there anything else I can tell them besides going to the doctor? Because parents never want to bring their kids and say they are still pooping. But then when they finally do, they call me and go, I'm so glad you harassed me for weeks about this. Is there something else that I can be sure they really are full of poop?
So, I mean, if they really are full of poop and they're not terribly overweight, if you lie them down flat and feel in the left lower quadrant, you'll feel a log there, something like a Coke can worth. Just roll right there. And the interesting thing that happens with those kids, too, is you'll feel the poop, and you can get them to feel it, and they're like, ooh, gross. And then it hurts, too. When you push on it, they're saying, does that hurt when I do that? And I'm pushing something big and brown, and, you know, and they're like, ooh, but it hurts, too. And it reproduces their pain, and they tend to believe after that. And so I try to avoid an x-ray. It's radiation. I don't want to x-ray everyone that thinks that might be constipated. We can just feel the poop there and asking enough questions about, is it hard? Because if it's hard, it's been there a while. Any other questions? We're all set. It's a long day and you guys are ready to go. See ya.